From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The United States Supreme Court is expected to make a decision on Donald Trump's Muslim ban version 3.0 any day now. The court will decide whether or not to consider Trump's public statements on his overtly anti-Muslim justification for the ban. Trump's ban is just the latest in a series of Islamophobic government policies that go back to even before the September 11th attacks. A new book by an academic studying anti-Muslim hate and bias for many years traces the history of Islamophobia in the United States. The book is by Khaled A. Beydoun, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Detroit Mercy School of Law and Senior Affiliated Faculty at the University of California, Berkeley's Islamophobia Research and Documentation Project. He joins me to discuss his new book, American Islamophobia, Understanding the Roots and Rise of Fear. Welcome to the program, Khaled.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we often think of September 11th as that turning point for American Muslims, where it went from, the group went from being one that was sort of, considered with some suspicion to basically being an overt new target for hate crimes, for government policies. But how much of a turning point was September 11th compared to the anti-Muslim biases and prejudices and policies that we saw before that moment?
I think it was a critical turning point in terms of expanding what I call structural Islamophobia. The fact that the state more robustly sort of embraced the idea that Muslim identity is tied to terrorism or the presumption of terrorism, and we saw that through obviously strident shifts like the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, the enactment of policies like the Patriot Act, and also the enactment of what was the Muslim Registry before Trump called it the Muslim Registry, this policy called NSEERS. So even though the stereotype about Arabs or Muslims being conflated with terrorism existed before 9/11, it became far more part of state structure and state policing policy moving forward.
And then, of course, with George W. Bush as president during 9/11 and the enactment of these policies, the launching of wars, we saw then Barack Obama, the nation's first African-American president, who unfortunately, just by his sheer existence, fanned the flame of greater Islamophobia by people who saw him, perhaps by his middle name, Hussein, as this Muslim Manchurian candidate of sorts. And now we have Donald Trump. You open your book with a story of your interaction with an Uber driver named Juan, who is an undocumented immigrant of a Latino background, who is on the cusp of converting to Islam. Tell us that story and why you felt what you felt for Juan.
Yeah, it was weeks after Trump was elected president. It was in the immediate wake of the first Muslim ban being signed into law by Trump a week after his inauguration. So when I was in LA and I met Juan while driving through the city, it was very much in during the early stages of Trump kickstarting his Islamophobic administration. It was, Trump obviously signs the first travel ban a week after he was inaugurated. So I didn't really know what to expect. I think we were all sort of sitting back, maybe anticipating that Trump was very much going to deliver on his promise to not only bring the Muslim ban into fruition, but to bring, other policies that he talked about into reality. Policies like, for instance, the Muslim Brotherhood, designating them as a terror group, which would have crippled Muslim civic and political organizations stateside. Policies like perhaps intensifying counter-radicalization. So I'm sitting in that Uber car, Juan's driving, and he's effectively testifying to me that he is very much on the cusp of embracing Muslim identity. Now, and I was really concerned. I'd lived in LA for a long time. I knew how the city functioned. I knew the specific neighborhood Juan came from, Pico Union. which is on the outskirts of the downtown area and has a high concentration of Latinx folks, and specifically undocumented Latinx people. And you see checkpoints popping up seemingly every day in those contexts. So Juan tells me that he is really considering embracing Islam. He's undocumented. He's somebody who's obviously, you know, really vulnerable because of his legal status, his ethnicity. And I paused and I stepped back for a second and knew that if he, by virtue of embracing Islam, he'd sort of occupy this really difficult intersection where he'd be undocumented, he'd be Latino, living in a poor working class context in LA. And then in addition to being Muslim, he'd be in a really vulnerable position. So I advised him that he maybe, you know, reconsider converting into Islam at this juncture when Islamophobia, xenophobia, and racism being flamed by the Trump administration was at very much its highest point.
So an interesting moment for you studying Islamophobia, worried for somebody converting to Islam because we know what lies in store for, what the terrain is for Muslim Americans today. Now, we see, you know, unprecedented levels of hate crimes against Muslims. That's the more societal Islamophobia, but your book focuses on the structural as well. But the two are linked, aren't they? Don't Americans take their cue from government policies? Doesn't the mere discussion of a Muslim ban fan the flames of street-level hate?
Yeah, exactly. And I think more than just hate crimes, right? So hate crimes are, you know, incidents that are in fact recorded, investigated, and prosecuted. It's also important to know that hate incidents, you know, incidents that aren't reported, aren't investigated or prosecuted, also skyrocketed during the rise or the moment during the rise of the Trump campaign. But there's a definite correlation, and I think it's really critical that we define and frame Islamophobia with that correlation in mind. The fact that when we have the expansion of structural Islamophobic policy, that communicates something specific to private citizens. If those laws and policies are built on the very baseline that ties Muslim identity to the presumption of terrorism, if law is telling citizens, if you see something, say something, then effectively it's endorsing and then emboldening private actors to engage in the project of punishing and prosecuting Muslims. So that dialectic is critical, and that's a critical dimension of my definition of Islamophobia, is that we definitely have state-sponsored or structural Islamophobia. On the other end, we have private Islamophobia, these hate crimes and hate incidents that are being unleashed by private actors. But that connection, that thread that ties the two together is really critical, because once structural Islamophobia is rising, that's emboldening private Islamophobia. It's directing private Islamophobia to also rise in kind.
Let's look at history. In your book, you trace the roots of modern Islamophobia to well over a century ago to a man named Omar ibn Said. Who was this man, and how did his story sort of launch the project of American Islamophobia?
Yeah, so it's important to understand that Muslim identity is deeply racialized, right? We think about Muslims, you know, almost narrowly as Arab, as Middle Eastern, sometimes as South Asian, and almost always as immigrant and new immigrants. And that's been sort of the Orientalist tradition, if you will, that enables the private Islamophobic imagining of Muslims, specifically Arab or Middle Eastern. Now, Omar ibn Said and his story is really critical because it sort of demystifies that racial or racialization of Muslim identity. Omar ibn Said was an enslaved African. He came from West Africa, who was part of this neglected and erased community of enslaved African Muslims who lived in the antebellum South, who were in fact the first Muslims in the pioneering Muslim communities here in the United States. Long before they arrived, long before Arab, Middle Eastern, South Asian, or immigrant Muslims ever stepped onto this country. So through a narrative or a vignette like Omar ibn Said, which I'm really careful and meticulous about telling in the book, we can grapple with sort of, again, dismantling this idea that Muslims are, you know, any one ethnicity or any one race. And in fact, when we talk about Muslim Americans here stateside, it's critical that we start with slavery and start with the idea that the Muslim American experience, the grand Muslim narrative, in fact, is rooted in blackness.
Right. We, of course, so perhaps the most famous black Muslim in the country is Malcolm X. And he really became a leader of black American Muslims. But he also became considered to be an enemy of the state by the U.S. government for largely his political radicalism, right?
Definitely. I think Malcolm X obviously is an archetype, but so is Muhammad Ali, right? Individuals who are, you know, I think by a far stretch, the most prominent, the most celebrated, the most iconic Muslim Americans, who are obviously the most politically trenchant, but also the most demonized. And I think they're the most demonized for two reasons. Obviously, their racial identity, being black men, leads to their demonization, but also because they come from the Nation of Islam, right? So before both Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X transition into Orthodox or Sunni Islam, it's remembered that their stories as Muslims started the Nation of Islam. And because that outfit was so vilified by the state, and specifically the FBI, we see the demonization of not only black Muslims, but Muslims at large being tied to that history.
You also talk today about how we need to see these intersections between Islamophobia, that is sort of structural and private hate against the Muslim community, to anti-black racism. Why is that connection important?
I think the I'm a critical race theorist. So in my academic research, race is salient. Race is, you know, has primal value. So when we talk about Islamophobia, you know, both in its new form, obviously the term Islamophobia is a relatively modern construction, but it's rooted in Orientalism, as I discussed in the book, that this entire longstanding project of anti-Muslim animus is very much rooted in white supremacy and is very much perpetuated by white supremacy. So we can understand how Islamophobia works today and how it worked during its formative stages. You know, most closely, if you understand how the American racial project is devised and navigated. And we know that whiteness was constructed, white identity, the racial classification was constructed in mirror opposite terms, the blackness. You know, obviously whiteness stood for not only citizenship, but, you know, obviously the highest echelons of humanity. Blackness during its early stages was synonymous with property and still today is tied to discursive understandings of inferiority. So through that racial production and that racial sort of narrative, we see Islam being tied to the idea that Muslim identity is also antithetical to whiteness.
Right. So you, we talked about what happened after September 11th, what's happening under Trump. But even the Obama administration, unfortunately, pushed many Islamophobic government policies. You mentioned the NCRs, the Muslim Registry, that started under Bush, I believe, continued under Obama. And also you point out this very interesting White House summit, the Countering Violent Extremism, that launched this new idea of policing in the United States that recasts the Muslim community as these sort of terrorists in waiting, right? The homegrown terrorism, these ideas of homegrown terrorism. How important is it to point out what happened under Obama as furthering the project of American Islamophobia?
I mean, really important. I think the reason that it's really, really critical to make that revelation is because it enables us to see Islamophobia as not only something that's being carried out by the right, right? That an administration that is touted as being a liberal and progressive administration, like the Obama administration, definitely engages and collaborates in this project of Islamophobia. And second, I consider counter-radicalization to be the most destructive form of structural Islamophobia. And it was not established by Trump, it was not established by Bush, it was established by the Obama administration. So it's critical to see that, and it's critical to understand how the left also extends and expands Islamophobia.
And yet Obama himself became this target. He symbolized to the radical right, to many of the same elements in Trump's base, symbolized that community that was displacing, undermining, or representing some sort of threat to white America. He received, I believe, the most number of death threats of any American president ever.
And he was the most obstructed president ever on account of his racial identity as well.
Obstructed, so, right.
Yeah. Obstructed, exactly, by Congress, obstructed by other political actors and so on. So it's critical to see that Obama's racial identity, him being a black man, obviously, signaled something very frightening to not only Trump, but the Tea Party and white populism at large.
Now, what we are experiencing today under Trump is such an important and desperate moment for many communities of color, whether you're African-American, whether you're an undocumented person, and whether you are Muslim. What are some of the ways in which we can not just call Trump out and call out the Islamophobia among his supporters and government, but have a critical response to Islamophobia so that no matter who is in power, a Democrat who might espouse certain lip service to racial identity and racial and identity politics, or someone overtly Islamophobic like Trump, because, you know, this has to stop. People are worried about what happened to Japanese Americans after World War II, happening to Muslim communities here. And it, you know, these days you can't be sure of anything.
Yeah, well, you know, I think the good news is finally, people care, broadly speaking, that Islamophobia is now, you know, a mainstream social justice issue in a way that it hasn't been. After 9/11, I think it was still very much fringe and not taken seriously, even by the left, by individuals that we classify as progressives. So now that there is that, you know, kind of broad social justice consciousness, I think the next critical step is to understand what Islamophobia actually is. I don't think there's much broad literacy as to the breadth of what Islamophobia is. I think people tend to understand it specifically as hate that's being inflicted by private actors or maybe, you know, aberrational sort of political leaders like a Trump. But it's critical to go that next step and see that Islamophobia is something that is, you know, again, unleashed by the left, by the center, and clearly by the right, in that it's enacted by policy as well as unleashed by private actors. And that's why I wrote this book, to be frank with you. This book is not an academic book. It's very much a broadly accessible book that hopefully can, extend that sort of education.
What role does the media play, not just under Trump, but before Trump, in sensationalizing stories that sort of encourage Islamophobia?
I think the media obviously plays a pivotal role. The media, their function is to effectively be the disseminator of information, the face of information to the broader community.
So, and not just Fox News, right?
No, not at all. I mean, even liberal and what we classify as centrist or moderate media like CNN. So obviously Fox is, you know, their bag is to sensationalize and engage in what we call explicit Islamophobia, which is dangerous. But I think once we do, and there's been studies done on CNN and MSNBC and so on and so forth, we see that we have another problem with those media outlets, that is that they don't do a great job, in fact, not even an adequate job, you know, giving platform to Muslim voices to speak on issues that pertain and concern Muslims. In the book, I talk about how in the immediate wake of the Muslim ban, for instance, I think CNN, 75% of the individuals they invited to talk about the travel ban were non-Muslims, were majority white men. That was also a similar statistic for MSNBC. So in addition to sensationalism, which we tend to gravitate toward, I think erasure of Muslim voices in the media is another critical crisis that we have to solve.
What do you make of Trump's iftar that he held this year after not holding one last year and defying, a White House trend that's been around for decades? He held an iftar this year to mark the holy month of Ramadan. And the statement that he issued, that the White House issued, was very different this year compared to last year. I'm wondering if he's trying to convince the Supreme Court that the travel ban, is not based on his personal Islam. Homophobia.
I think it was a big dog and pony show, obviously. The individuals who attended were largely diplomats, foreign ministers. I don't think there was any representation from the Muslim American community. So a closer look reads like an indictment. The fact that Trump has no resonance and nobody, Muslim Americans view him, I think, categorically as a pariah, that they wouldn't attend an iftar held by him.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Khaled. Is there a website people can find out more about the work that you do?
My website, www.khaledbeydoun.com. I'm also on Twitter, and I highly recommend people, obviously, to check out the book, inshallah.
The book is called American Islamophobia, and we'll link to your website from our site. Thanks so much, Khaled.
Thanks so much, Sonali.
Khaled A. Beydoun is an associate professor of law at the University of Detroit's Mercy School of Law and senior affiliated faculty at University of California, Berkeley's Islamophobia Research and Documentation Project. His new book that we've been discussing is entitled American Islamophobia: Understanding the Roots and Rise of Fear. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.